Hello and welcome to The Lawyer Podcast. I'm Katrin Griffiths, editor of The Lawyer.
And I'm Christian Smith, litigation editor of The Lawyer.
And back in The Lawyer newsroom, it's our first podcast of 2024. And although most people have been back at work for a couple of weeks, it feels like there's still only one story dominating the news agenda.
That's right. The ongoing fallout of the post office scandal has gripped the nation and the legal profession.
And it's left many lawyers rather uncomfortable as questions about the conduct of those involved, from criminal prosecutors to city firms to in-houses, come under daily attack.
It has left the profession with difficult questions to answer, not just in this case, but more widely. Just how aggressive can you be in pursuit of your client's interests? Where is the line between being a good lawyer and acting unethically? And has the profession fallen into a hole where the sort of behaviour we've seen in the post office case has become the norm?
In other words, should some city litigators be asking themselves, are we the baddies? Well, to look into this, we are joined by senior litigation reporter Annabel Tinson, who has been covering the story.
Hi both, thank you for having me.
So to kick off, Christian, could you give us a high-level summary of where we are right now with the post office scandal?
Well, I think most people know about the post office scandal. Everyone got very excited in the new year, of course, when the ITV drama Mr. Bates and the Post Office came out. I won't go into all the details because it would take far longer than we have time for today. But suffice to say that lawyers in particular have been involved in the scandal from start to now. I mean, it's not finished yet, really. There have been plenty of examples of criminal prosecution, several hundred sub-postmasters were prosecuted by the post office. There's also been several examples of civil litigation, including the case of Lee Castleton in 2007, and then the group litigation that was brought. That was the subject of the ITV drama Mr. Bates and the post office. There have been, shall we say, examples of good legal behaviour in the cases, and some that are coming under scrutiny right now in what is now the ongoing post office inquiry into what has been called the most widespread miscarriage of justice in modern British legal history. Annabel, who has been covering the case, has been looking a lot into the firms that are involved, and she's going to take us through some of those right now.
Sure. So to start, Cartwright King is known as one of the law firms that the post office has been instructing in a lot of the private prosecutions of sub-postmasters. We've also got Freeths, which is, I suppose, maybe one of the goodies that you're talking about, who represented the 555 postmasters in the High Court. They also represent around 400 of that number in the compensation scheme for the 555. Alongside them, there's also Alshaw Goddard, who is advising the Department for Business and Trade on the quantification of compensation for the 555. And Dentons is the neutral claim facilitator to ensure fair and efficient resolution of the claims for the 555. Now, we also have the post office, which was defended by Womble Bond Dickinson in the High Court claim that Freeths bore. Herbie's was later drafted in for backup and took over at some point. A little bit murky when they did take over, but according to people familiar with the matter, they were definitely fully taken over by the time of the 10-day mediation for the settlement. Herbie's also represented the post office in the inquiry, but have been since conflicted out. Burgess Salmon and Phil Fisher took over in that case. Herbie's, however, is still instructed in by the post office in two of the compensation schemes, known as the historical shortfall scheme and the overturned conviction scheme. And then lastly, we have Peterson Peters, who has been instructed by the post office in the criminal appeals. So when the sub-postmasters that wanted their convictions overturned went to the Court of Appeal, Peterson Peters was instructed by the post office in these. So as well as for freedom of information requests. So if anyone has a question for the post office and they put in a freedom of information request, Peterson Peters does the disclosure for this.
I think that gives a really good summary of how confusing the whole thing is, because there's about a million firms involved, a million different angles
Absolutely.
To it.
However, having said that, there's an awful lot of scrutiny over a couple of firms in particular, and one of those firms is Womble Bond Dickinson and their role. If we can talk about Bates versus the Post Office actually as well. Now, that has, you know, that is an outstanding example of highly aggressive litigation undertaken by the Post Office and its lawyers against all of those sub-postmasters.
Well, Richard Moorhead is a professor of law and professional ethics at the University of Exeter. He's been following the Post Office scandal closely and writing about it. And I spoke to him earlier about aggressive litigation.
The question that a lot of people, both within the profession and outside the profession, are asking is where the line is between acting in your client's best interest and or following their instructions and overstepping that line into areas of misconduct and even worse.
Yeah.
When it comes to aggressive litigation, where is that line?
It sort of depends what sorts of things you're talking about. So there's all of the cases, criminal and civil, there have been big problems with disclosure. And the lawyers have really made what looks like, and we'll wait to see what the inquiry says, but what looks like very serious disclosure errors. If they are errors, they may be a bit more deliberate or opportunistic than that. And that's one of the things, again, the inquiry will look at. So there's those questions. There's basic questions of integrity. And often in these cases, the cases that become really serious, what I typically see is lawyers stepping beyond, if you like, putting the best a gloss on a client's story, putting the best case forward towards putting forward something which is misleading. And again, lawyers get a bit carried away with their strategy, the cleverness of their tactics. Think they can ignore the facts that are privileged that they know about and when they construct their stories. And they typically slip up there when they've made mistakes. They slip up by misrepresenting the case in a way which is misleading. So that's probably the biggest problem. The other thing about the Bates case is, and this is a bit harder to judge in a way, is an excess of aggression. So Mr. Justice Fraser really criticised the strategy in the case as being essentially, he didn't use these phrases, but a scorched earth approach to try every point, take every point, try to exhaust your opponents. And it actually succeeded in the Post Office case because the postmaster settled because they ran out of money. What's excessive aggression? And I think the rules at the minute are pretty loose around that, taking unfair advantage being the main basis, or, you know, misleading, failing to disclose, et cetera, et cetera. So the that's an area where I think the line is hazier, and that's harder for people to judge. So I've got a little bit more sympathy there.
Richard also went on to say, when it comes to aggressive litigation, what the case law says is that the strategy that a law firm or lawyers come up with, they are also responsible for. So you can't just hang your hat on this idea that the client has asked you to do something, and so therefore you have to do it.
Yeah, I mean, that's the classic we're only following orders defence, which clearly is not, it's not sustainable at all. I do think that there's lots of, in terms of the conduct of litigation, and the SRA, I know, are looking at this very closely in the round, is actually whether we would see this will mark a potential change in the way that law firms actually conduct litigation. What's your best guess, Annabelle? You've been talking to a lot of litigators on this specific topic. Mm-hmm. Do you sense that people are going to rein it in? I mean, you know, I would actually say that there are plenty of litigators who absolutely pride themselves, and it's their brand, if you like, to be the biggest guns in town, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Do you think that there's a sense that they're looking closely at their own behaviour and that they are, you know, they're happy to sort of scrutinise their own actions?
I think there is. I've spoken to a number of people over the last couple of days, and, you know, they're very willing to talk off the record, of course, on this topic. I mean, one litigator said to me yesterday, you know, well, everyone's done things they're not proud of. They said that.
Wow.
But another thing that was said was that perhaps some of these techniques are now seen as old-fashioned, actually. People don't expect lawyers to behave like this in the modern age, and perhaps we should look again at how we're behaving in, well, how lawyers are behaving when using delay tactics.
That's fascinating, isn't it? I can't get out of my head the fact that last week, Quinn Emanuel, who are, I'm not suggesting any malpractice on their part, but they bank their reputation as being probably some of the most aggressive litigators in the world, saw their London revenue go up by nearly 50%. So obviously there is a place for that aggressive tactic in the modern world. So it's obviously not going anywhere, and it pays.
Yeah, absolutely. There is always going to be some clients that want that set of tactics, if you like. But the question is actually whether the clients are right and whether the law firms should really be pandering to sometimes a sort of Hollywood version of what a litigator is, which is all sort of, you know, thunder and lightning and coming in and, you know. So I think the sort of the wider question is the culture around litigation has always been about fight it out in court. That lots of litigators say, well, our job is not to take it to court and we need to settle because we're doing it the best for the clients, etc. But that's not fundamentally what really sort of governs the behaviour, and that's certainly not, in my view, what governed the behaviour of the lawyers involved in the post office scandal. Is there anything else, I think, Annabelle, that you know, looking forward, where what their predictions are going to be in the wake of this? Is there something that people are saying, actually, you know, we have to get together to discuss this really?
There wasn't particularly on discussing it, but a couple of things that people mentioned was that perhaps judges need to take a firmer stance. So, and apparently some divisions, if you like, are better at this than others. So people say the commercial court is really, really good at calling people out. One other person went said, take that one step further. There's certain judges that are really good at calling these kind of things out. The Competition Appeal Tribunal has been hailed for being very good at keeping things to timetable and calling bad behaviour out. Certain other divisions, a couple of people mentioned the Chancery Division wasn't as good. Mm-hmm. Litigation can rumble on for years there. So another thing, as well as that timetabling and, you know, judges telling people off. Another thing someone mentioned was that perhaps more people should be reporting people to the Bar Standards Board, the SRA, that kind of thing, when they see bad behaviour.
Mm. There's a difference, isn't there, as well? So if you've got that delaying tactics, if it's two massive financial institutions coming up against each other, that's a rather different thing from when there's a sort of a mass claimants and there may be a public interest, you know, or a consumer sort of issue. And presumably from what you said, you know, if the judges in either the commercial court or the Competition Appeal Tribunal are much better at that, you know, that should show Chancery Division the way to go. Of course, you know, we can all sit there and talk about Jarndyce and Jarndyce and sort of, you know, the famous Dickensian sort of endless suits. But it's remarkable how that has persisted.
Definitely. And just to bring it back to the post office litigation again, the group litigation, I think one point that's really interesting is a person familiar with the dispute said that the post office and its legal advisors, you know, would have known that every time they delayed something, that would have been less money for those postmasters and more money for the funder and more money for the legal representatives. And that's where I suppose the moral argument comes in, as opposed to, like you said, you know, when it's just two companies, when it's a group of real people, 555 people that have, you know, faced a lot, that's where the moral argument comes in, I think.
And actually, if I can bring in our colleague Gabriel Kennedy interviewed Imogen Randall, who is now a legal director, was an associate at Freeths for the sub-postmasters on the Bates case. And part of her quote goes as follows, you know, they didn't give ground on anything, so that made it all the more expensive and time-consuming and frustrating. I mean, that's the level. I mean, you know, the other side knows what the tactics are. It's really, really clear, and it will therefore be clear to the judge. So it's going to be interesting to see whether the judges are going to be given sort of specific instructions in the future to call this out.
Yeah, and I think there'll be a lot of people listening to what we're saying right now and saying, 'twas ever thus, and, you know, this is how it's always been and all that sort of thing. But I think, you know, lawyers are not coming out of this story particularly well, let's be honest. I mean, obviously, the Freeth's lawyers and people who are acting for the postmasters are. Tom Goodhead from Pogus Goodhead has written an op-ed for the lawyer saying as much, and that, you know, there's two sides to the story and there's good people doing good things out there. And I think it's important to remember that. But I think what will stick in most people's minds are the lawyers who acted for the post office and threw up all these things, and the quite heavy criticism that they and others are coming in for. Obviously, again, 'twas ever thus, you know, the public have a particular view of lawyers at times that is based on Hollywood movies sometimes and that sort of thing as well, you know, said the journalist to the lawyer. But I think that there'll be many lawyers out there who are looking at this, and as one of those people you spoke to, Annabelle, said, will be going, ooh, am I comfortable with all of the cases I've run in the past? Would I do that again now? Am I so happy about that?
If you had an ITV drama made about all of your cases, would you be particularly happy about that? I'm not sure everyone would be happy. I wonder if we could sort of widen it again, because one of the many important things that's come out of this terrible story is that, you know, the concept of litigation funding has kind of impinged upon the public consciousness in a way that it never has before, and in a way that litigation funders have often been characterized in some quarters as, you know, sort of rotten old American-y type ambulance chasing type of people. But obviously here Ethereum were doing something which has ended up being ultimately for the public good. And there's a big debate brewing in quite a lot of the papers about the importance of litigation funding and indeed a government response as well. Let's talk a little bit about that. Christian.
Absolutely. To take it back to July last year, there was a Supreme Court decision in a case that is now called PACCAR. PACCAR is a truck company. But that was all about litigation funding, and the Supreme Court ruled that the way most litigation funding agreements are drafted are basically not allowed or illegal. And that threw the whole litigation funding market into chaos. Fast forward to the end of last week when Alan Bates wrote an op-ed in the Financial Times basically saying, because of PACCAR, if we had the group litigation now, we wouldn't have been able to do it because we wouldn't have been able to have our litigation funding agreement in the way that we did, and we would have not have been able to bring the case to court. And then on Monday of this week, Alex Chalk, the Justice Secretary, announced that they were going to be reversing effectively, at the earliest legislative opportunity, in his words, the PACCAR decision, and making it so that litigation funding in the way that they were done before, which is effectively based on a percentage of damages, is permitted. There's a lot more detail to that. Some people have said to me that they don't necessarily think that the litigation funding market was in such a state of disrepair following that judgment that it needed such an immediate response, but others have said the opposite to me, so we'll see. But I did catch up with Susan Dunn, who's the founder of litigation funder Harbour, and I asked her actually if the government's announcement came off the back of Alan Bates's intervention or whether it was going to happen anyway.
I think it's both. I think that because there was the article from Alan Bates in the FT on Saturday, where he wrote to say, but for funding, we wouldn't be where we are today. And I think that was an eye opener for people who didn't necessarily, I mean, it was featured a little bit in the drama, but it is an eye opener to people to recognize that in the uncertain world that PACCAR has created, funding may not have been available to these people who simply could not have afforded, because we now know the behavior of the post office and their lawyers was deliberately scorched earth to make life as difficult as possible. And they needed all the help they could get to get this case to its conclusion. But we do know that Alex Chalk in particular is very supportive of the reversal to PACCAR and is very sensitive to access to justice and making sure that it's not just the consumer, but, you know, citizens, because that's what the sub-postmasters are, the citizens having the ability to enforce their rights and be properly armed to do so against people who are intent on making their life incredibly difficult.
Yeah, I think what the whole situation with litigation funding has been this week is, it shows the extraordinary reach of the story and just how many angles it has and how long it's probably got to run, to be quite frank. But it actually reflects in lots of ways what somebody I spoke to a while ago about litigation funding said in the context of wider litigation, which is that the existence of that now means that those firms and parties to litigation acting on the defendant's side, who used to, whether or not they were against another corporate or whoever it might have been, would just drop anchor and go, right, cool, you've brought a claim against us, we'll drop anchor, it's going to take 6 years, you're going to spend 20 million quid, 5 million quid, whatever it is, to do it. That doesn't necessarily work so much now, thanks to litigation funding, because if you've got litigation funding, basically you can say, well, that's fine, it'll take us another few years to get this sorted. Well, we've still got all the money to do it, and we'll get to the point at the end, and hopefully, because we think we're going to win, that'll be good for us. And then what's happening is those on the defendant side, the clients effectively, are sitting there 5 years down the line going, oh, well, we dropped anchor. Now we're 20 million quid in the red for litigation, for lawyers' fees, and we're not really any better off because we're still just as likely to win or lose this case. So why should we be doing this anymore?
I suppose the only counterpoint to that is that it's not completely foolproof. Like in the Bates litigation, they did still run out of money eventually, or run out of money that the funder was prepared to give because they ended up settling.
Yeah, I do think that there will be a lot of people out there who work, I think, across the board in law firms, not just in litigation, who are perhaps feeling a little bit squirmy on watching kind of the national conversation on this and asking the question of, well, like we called it, are we the baddies? Because in many ways in this story, the lawyers are the baddies. And I think, you know, when you start at a law firm, your image of a law firm and what goes on is pretty, you're pretty ignorant about it until you actually do it. A lot of it's based on watching things like Suits and Boston Legal and whatever that might be. You sort of hope that, when you're aware of the sort of stereotype that big corporate lawyers kind of screw over the little guy and that sort of thing. And you sort of, you know, I think almost all people who go into that environment, they're not that naive, but at the same time, you're also hoping that you never get put in a position where you have to do something that you're not comfortable with. But I think after a while, you sort of you get used to the environment that you're in. Because the thing with this whole scandal, and listening back to the excellent BBC podcast series on it has reinforced that, is that on the one hand, you kind of hear about some of the, let's say, behaviours or failures of some of the lawyers involved, and you go, well, that's just outrageous. And then you realise how many people are involved and how widespread it is, and it makes you realise that we've sort of normalised this behaviour.
And I think there's a, you know, you use the word disconnect, and I think the disconnect is real. And there is a difficulty when you're in a profession that pays a lot, where the rewards are huge, where there is a certain way of behaving and sort of aggression and dynamism are prized, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And that you scorn these basic questions about impact on human beings as being impossibly naive, when they're not naive, actually, because in fact, perhaps one should be judged by the impact of your cases. Even actually, when there are two sort of huge corporates, you know, duking it out in court, there are still going to be real life consequences, and perhaps, you know, and it's as much a challenge to us as legal journalists to actually looking at the real life impact of these big cases on the wider world. People have started looking on that in terms of climate, but actually in terms of real people, whether it be postmasters, whether it be, you know, people sitting in jobs where, you know, that are being restructured or what have you. But there could be any number of ways that you could look at those impact. And I think perhaps the time has come for the sort of the richer end of the legal profession to think about that disconnect and where that takes us.
I would add, though, as well, that there are plenty of lawyers who are in those jobs on a day-to-day basis who don't have that disconnect. But realize that when things that they're uncomfortable with come along, sometimes what option do they have? Yeah, are they gonna, you know, all of a sudden go, nah, I quit?
Yeah.
No. I mean, that's also quite naive.
And that's why this conversation is so important, because it can only be had at a high level within firms, and it can only be had when the tone is being explicitly set by those partners. If an associate is throwing his or her weight about because they're modelling what a partner has done, you know, that's what's going to happen. So it's a difficult one, because actually you can't, it's not something you can point to go and say, X firm here is the model for all the aggressive behaviour. It's actually much deeper, and it's much more problematic than I think than any of us had really emotionally understood it to be. Well, it's been quite a few weeks. Thank you, Annabelle.
Thank you.
That is all we have time for on this episode of The Lawyer Podcast.
Thank you for listening. As always, you can contact us at podcast@thelawyer.com and tell us how wrong we are.
And how naive we are.
How idealistic
we are, yeah.
And you can, of course, find out more about anything we've been discussing, including all of Annabelle's excellent reporting on the issue at thelawyer.com.
And we'll be back again in a fortnight with lots of new and exciting content for you. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.